Welcome to this episode of City Talks, where we'll be looking at the role that transport plays in the success of UK cities. I'm Ben Harrison, and I'm filling in for Andrew this month. Over the course of the last Parliament, and in the months since the general election, a great deal of policy focus has been dedicated to supporting our cities to improve their economic performance. And investments in transport have been seen as an important way to deliver growth all across the country. When invited to put proposals to central government for city deals or growth deals, places have tended to emphasise the importance of transport for their future, while central government itself has invested much time, resource and political credibility in major schemes like High Speed 2. And the Chancellor's ambition to connect the cities of the North into a northern powerhouse puts transport at the centre of UK PLC's growth strategy. But why fundamentally is transport so important? Are the investments currently planned at a national and local level going to deliver the promised benefits? And how can cities best organise their transport systems to reduce congestion and support growth? Joining me to discuss these questions and more, I have Dr. John Lamont, Chief Executive of Transport for Greater Manchester, Bridget Roswell, Senior Advisor of Volterra and a Non-Executive Director at Network Rail, and Vernon Everett, MD of Marketing and Communications at Transport for London. Bridget, if we could perhaps start with you first, could you perhaps just give us your take on why transport is so important to economic growth at both the national level and I guess in particular for our urban areas?
At one level, it's completely obvious. Without a transport system, you don't have an economy. You're a peasant, you're at subsistence levels. Transport means trade, and trade requires transport, and trade is what makes economies grow. That's been true right through human history. So how does being improving a transport system generate further trade and further ability to exploit innovation? And indeed, if we go back to the origins of the Industrial Revolution and the cotton trade, Manchester got rich because it brought together technology, which enabled it to create at scale, but without the ability to move the stuff around, get the cotton in and the finished goods out, none of that technology could ever have been put in place. So that remains true now as it was then. We need to be able to get goods in and out, services in and out. But of course, now we've become more of a service economy. It's more about the people getting together with the people. London has become successful because it's been able to build on its ability to put people together and increase its catchment area. So urban transport is about enabling people to move around in the city, but also to get the workers in and out. That's true for London, it's true for Manchester. But the other part of it, of course, is international transport, being able to fly out to China to sell your services, but also getting people in to be able to do trade with you. And that's the intercity part of the story. We've got some way, I think, in getting understanding of that commuter bit. The intercity bit is still people seem to struggle with the idea that transport is a necessary component of growth.
So, I mean, building on those points from Bridget, John, I mean, Manchester's clearly been the focus of the Chancellor's Northern Powerhouse Initiative for the best part of 18 months now. From your perspective, how much of the delivery of that powerhouse depends upon better transport connectivity on an intercity basis as much as within the Manchester City region?
So I think the first thing to say is that we don't do transport for transport's sake. It's always to support economic growth. And if you look at Manchester, and Bridget rightly mentions our place from the Industrial Revolution, then it's not just about travel within the Greater Manchester area. It's about moving between the cities, having freedom of movement that's actually going to get us to the next level of economic growth. Because at the moment, we're not a net contributor to UK PLC. We're not generating sufficient tax to justify our way in the world. And actually, we want to be a world city. So if we want to be like that, then let's have a look at some of the comparators in Holland, in the Randstad or in the Rhine-Ruhr. And what marks out those agglomerations of cities is they've got the sort of connectivity that means that it's no matter at all to move between Cologne and Bonn or between Amsterdam and Rotterdam. You just take it for granted. It's easy to do. Well, in comparison, it takes an hour by train to get from Leeds to Manchester, a shade around 40 miles, which is absolutely crazy. And it's a barrier to people being able to take jobs and therefore to generate the growth. And that's what we all want. And likewise with Liverpool, and likewise across to Sheffield and to Hull and to Newcastle. And if we want to get the real benefits and then become the Northern Powerhouse, transport's where you start.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Vernon, when John there is talking about the economies of scale and really building an economy at scale that can compete globally, I mean, in many respects, London and Transport for London has led the way in a UK context when thinking about transport at the city region level and really moving large numbers of people across the city every day. It'd be good just to get your sense of how important London's transport network has been to its recent renaissance, I guess, since the 1990s, and what some of the big challenges that you face are as Transport for London in keeping that going.
Yes, and just to build on John's point, I think one of the major challenges that we're faced with is harnessing the enormous population growth that there is in London for good and productive use. London is bigger than it's ever been today, 8.6 million people, it will be 10 million by 2030. Those people want to work, they want to make trips, and they want to do all the sorts of things that Bridget mentioned lead to a productive economy. So we've got to harness that and make that a positive thing. Transport is absolutely at the centre of it. And I think if you look back to when Transport for London was created in the year 2000, there's been a 10.5 percentage point shift out of cars and onto public transport. And that's been absolutely critical in enabling the growth of London and its various economies and spreading the sorts of economic sectors that London excels in. So it's not only just financial services now, it's tech, it's fashion, it's all sorts of things which have been enabled by that. And I think the core of why that has happened was the really rather ingenious way in which the Greater London Act in 2000 was actually set up, which combined, it locked up land use planning with the economic plan for the city as a whole with transport. So all of those things are taken in the round so that everything that you do on transport is connected to something in the real economy. More jobs, more houses, and everything that goes and everything that goes with that. So it's been a combination of that, I think, very thoughtful approach to establishment of TfL, which requires us not only to get tomorrow's train service and bus service out in as efficient way as possible, but also plan for the next 10, 20, 30 years as well to make this population growth productive.
So that's really important, that long-term plan. Mm. And it's taken, you know, a decade, I guess, really, from the establishment of the GLA to get that kind of integration really to work properly. Because at the beginning, that never hadn't really been done like that. And you're absolutely right. I think the GLA Act really made a big difference in bringing TfL, creating TfL, and then bringing it together with the GLA. So when I was the first chief economist of the GLA, that began that kind of feedback loop, if you like, between what was possible on the transport side, what the economy was doing, what planners wanted to do. And we began to kind of triangulate around all those different policy decisions and then to begin to look out further.
Mm.
So there's now, as a result of the GLA, there's an infrastructure plan to 2050. We haven't got funding till 2050. That's not true. We might come back to that. But at least there's a kind of conceptualisation of the building blocks which would make that possible. And we've not had that before. I don't think we've ever, in fact, in London, had that.
So picking up on that point then, Bridget, the idea of building blocks and thinking about if we want to realise some of the ambitions that you were talking about, John, in the north and for the northern powerhouse, it would be great just to get a general sense as to what we think those building blocks are then. If we think long-term certainty is going to be one of them, presumably allied to long-term certainty over funding as well. I mean, what do we need to be putting in place to, you know, turn the rhetoric of the Northern Powerhouse into reality on the ground?
So I think it really starts with having a vision and a strategy that looks long-term. So London's got its 2050 look. We've just launched a 2040 vision, and you do have to look out that far. That's the first thing. But no good just linking it, just having a transport view. It has to be linked intrinsically to housing, because like London, we face a big problem with population growth. Where are they going to go? What are they going to do? What are their transport needs? So you absolutely have to link planning with transport, with housing, with all the other bits that are going to make the sense of place. So you have to have that. You have to have a long-term view, and then you have to have some funding certainty around what you're trying to do, because these things are long-term projects. they require long-term investment, and you need to have some certainty of that, partly to attract investors into what you're trying to do, but also so that we can attract and retain the right people in the industries to be able to deliver it as well.
Mm. You're absolutely right. And the word you didn't mention, which perhaps you should have done, is the devolution word.
Mm.
Because you can't do that if you haven't got a kind of a ribbon which runs round your geography and enables you to bring these things together. Otherwise, it's just pie in the sky stuff. And the other thing about the long-term thing is, of course, you can guarantee if you don't have the transport, you won't get the growth. That you can guarantee, but you can't guarantee if you have the transport that you will. So it does require some judgment calls and some bets, if you like, on how all of this can be put together. And for that, again, you need local people who are prepared to put their shoulders to the wheel, if you like. Mm. It can't be done on a national basis. It can't be done by the Treasury deciding what the right project is. And therefore, it means taking some risk. Risk on funding.
I think the devolution agenda is absolutely right. It's about local people making local decisions based on the local knowledge and local needs. And you can't do that solely from Westminster. Equally, it's true to say that you can't do it in isolation. It does need to be partnerships with government, which is where Transport for the North comes in. It's a partnership with government to try and deliver on all that. But I think also it's very true that there is going to be local investment has to be part of the answer. You can't always rely on national government to provide all the resources, which is why in Greater Manchester we've had a transport fund, others are doing similarly, where we're taking local raised money to actually put into those investments to make those transformational changes.
Just on your point, John, we'll come to Vernon in a second about the London experience over the last 10 years, but you raised Transport for the North in amongst that picture as well, and I think people who aren't immersed in this agenda would be forgiven for being a bit confused, I guess, in terms of, you know, they hear about Transport for Greater Manchester, the devolution to a city region level to be thinking about these issues. There's also Transport for the North and thinking about, you know, the pipeline of investments that are going to be required region-wide. How are these things fitting together? Can you take us through that?
Yeah, sure. So what we recognised was that city regions, we have to have our transport plans, our economic plans for each of those city regions to make them work. But as I mentioned before, if you're going to really get the North working as an economic unit, as a single economy, actually it means the cities talking to each other. Mm. And we are, for the first time, talking to each other. So Liverpool, Manchester, Leeds, Sheffield, Hull and Newcastle have all got together to say, okay, if we want to have a single economy, what are those transformational interventions that would make that work? We've done a little bit of that through Rail North, where we've started to look at what the new rail franchises should look like. But this is bigger and more long-term, which says, what would you need in terms of big road links? What would you need in big rail links? This is where things like HS3, Transnorth comes in. It's where the Transpennine Tunnel under the Peak District comes in between Manchester and Sheffield, and the links on the road network to Newcastle. All of those things which are more than any single city region can deliver, but actually when you start talking to the other together, you realise what's needed on a pan-northern scale. And what we're doing now through Transport for the North is bringing in all the northern authorities, Northumbria, Cumbria, Lancashire, Cheshire, to actually say, right, what's the one view from the north? If we spoke as one, and this is a third of England talking, then actually we can be a powerful voice.
I guess just picking up on Bridget's point there, though, that a challenge in amongst that will be prioritisation, won't it, across such a broad geography with so many different city regions, I guess each vying for their priority to feature towards the top of that list.
So the commitment from Transport for the North is to come up with a prioritised set of interventions. Because what is more powerful than Liverpool advocating a scheme in Newcastle or Hull advocating something in Manchester? We've seen that a little bit. That's how the Northern Hub actually got off the ground through the Northern Way, and people advocating, actually, it's not just a problem in Manchester to be sorted. It's a Northern problem that needs sorting. And we're taking that to the next level.
Fantastic. To bring us a bit back down to the city region level, Vernon, it would be fascinating to hear from your perspective. I mean, we talked about it briefly before in terms of governance at the city region level and in the context of devolution. Just get a sense of the role that the mayor's played in all of this.
Well, having a powerful mayor whose primary roles and responsibilities actually centre around transport has been absolutely crucial. And we've been lucky enough to have two mayors who absolutely get transport and what it does and what it does for the city. And what that's enabled us to do is to argue for steady and sustained capital investment in London's transport infrastructure. So prior to the year 2000, capital investment was erratic, very erratic in London. You didn't know what you were spending from one year to the next. Now we've moved to 5-year capital settlements, which give you that long-term certainty, which enable you to be more strategic in your outlook, to line up your suppliers more effectively so that you can deliver these things more cheaply, and that you can develop skills. Because don't forget, you know, we're talking about infrastructure investment across the whole country, which is demanding a completely new approach to the skill base in the country, and we're short of engineers, we're short of people that are going to come in and do all of this work. So that steady and sustained funding has been absolutely at the core of making improvements in London to the reliability of public transport. And on the Tube, for example, what that means is that we are now running trains every 100 seconds on some of our lines, and even then it's pretty crowded.
Yeah,
and you're having to having to keep going. And we've now moved on, of course, to articulating the case for Crossrail 2. Crossrail 1, which is the east to west new rail route in London, is only a few short years now from entering passenger service. That will provide some breathing space in London, but we now want to move on to Crossrail 2, which is the north-south London equivalent. And just building on Bridget's point, the other thing is what we would say is we can pay for a lot of this ourselves if it's funded through our own local funding mechanisms, if we're allowed to retain more of our own tax take. So London only retains about 5% of its own tax. You know, if you're in Germany, that's 30%. With most US cities, it's even more than that. So you can actually use the economic growth along those lines to harness that and plough that back and reinvest that in transport. And to John's point about the resource allocation across cities, I think we're all very clear now that this is not a zero-sum game. What's good for London is good for every other city, and if you apply this logic that free local communities to actually harness their own economic growth and reinvest that, then that's going to be that will stand us in good stead, and you'll get very efficient resource allocation out of that.
I mean, I think that's an absolutely key point in amongst all of this. And I mean, I was struck by, you know, the idea that the mayor enables a city to, or has enabled London to make its case to central government more powerfully. But I mean, I suppose alongside that, it's also allowed a prioritisation across the city region itself to take place, hasn't it? And also what limited fiscal or funding powers the mayor has, or cities generally have at the moment, he's been able to use them. So I'm thinking like the supplementary business rate, for example, to get those schemes like Battersea and like Crossrail moving.
Yeah.
Battersea isn't a supplementary business rate. The only supplementary business rate so far is Crossrail 1, which was really the first of these big schemes where we began to win the argument that transport is necessary for the economy. But there was still a lot of scepticism about that. Decade on, I think that there's general acceptance that transport is important to the economy, but nonetheless that's still the only case. The Northern Line extension at Battersea is financed through simply the rates that will be created because you're going to get development which you would not otherwise get. But it's not a higher tax rate, it's just, if you like, normal tax rate, but you're capturing that as the vehicle which will enable you to pay back the loan that is necessary to build the thing in the first place. So that's a big distinction.
Yes,
it's not additional taxes. But actually, we went with the supplementary business rate for Crossrail 1 because it was necessary in political terms, but I still think it's double taxation. I'm still against it.
From your perspective, John, do you think now with a mayor for Greater Manchester on the horizon, would you expect to see more of those kind of mechanisms being used at a Greater Manchester level to unlock transport investment?
Yes, I do. I mean, we've got an interim mayor in place, Tony Lloyd, who's there right now, and I think what it gives us is an accountability to the public in a clear and transparent way. We've had the first of the combined authorities in the UK, and actually that's worked pretty effectively as 10 districts, local authorities, working together, who've actually achieved much of that prioritisation. I mentioned the Transport Fund, it's out there, it's being delivered. So it's not that, but it's very much about having an accountable person so that when we want to do things like bus franchising and we want to set fares, that the public are very clear who it is that's at the top of that organisation, who is making those calls, and it's a very transparent process. So that's one of the reasons that we've gone down the mayoral route, and as you rightly say, in 2017 we'll have a directly elected mayor, and we'll look forward to that. I think we've got a slightly different model from London in the way it's constructed, which is more of a cabinet-based approach, and it's more of a collective decision-making process. So learnt the lessons from London, gone for a slightly different modification, and I suspect as more city deals are announced and more mayors become apparent, so this will move onwards. It's a journey, but it is about that accountability and transparency point.
Vernon, you.
And the other thing I would introduce at this point, just to build on all of that stuff, is it's not only infrastructure investment and more efficient day-to-day services that starts deriving the economic benefits that we were talking about. It's making it easier for people to use public transport. When you start bringing these bodies together and you start bringing the different services together and integrating that through an integrated means of payment, for example, take Oyster in London as an example, Opal in Sydney, you know, they're all over the world. Mm. But as soon as you start making it easy for people to transact with you, and you give them an integrated ticketing system and high quality customer information, that of itself will encourage more people to use public transport, even before you've been able to introduce the capital, introduce the benefits of the capital investment, which by definition will run along a longer time frame. So I think the other thing I'd just say is that alongside all of this commitment to capital investment and to running operations more effectively and to allocating resources more effectively, not to lose sight of the customer side of this, which is to enable them to just to simply go and use your transport system. And things like contactless payment in London is a very good example of that, where, you know, why force people to convert their money into transport money when they can just literally tap their bank card and travel?
Yeah.
And that's also really important as well from an operational efficiency point of view, because these places are crowded. You don't want people queuing up, you want them just to tap and to go. So I think part of this equation is also thinking about that. What's the customer proposition which is going to get people out of private vehicles onto public transport, and how can we as transport operators and authorities make their lives easier?
Of course, the equivalent in Manchester is the tram system. So it's also about being easy to use, being visible, but also being frequent, which is the other piece of the customer experience. You don't have to think, do I need to go now, or is it another half an hour, or is it the next 5 minutes? You rock up, yeah. There'll be one in a few minutes, and there'll be an information board or on your phone to tell you when the next one is going to be due. And that makes it easy and seamless. People get in their cars because it's easy and seamless. If you want to get them out, it has to be easy and seamless.
So, I mean, it feels, with the way that each of you are talking, that we're on the cusp of seeing good progress being made in how we think about investing in our urban transport systems. You're looking sceptical about that, which is good, because I was going to ask, what within that context, what are some of the remaining big challenges and risks of the kind of things that we've seen to date?
We all know, sitting in cities and being involved in cities, how important transport is. And for John and Vernon, it's their job. I've come from a place where I had to fight through that change in, partial change in attitude. Mm-hmm. And I see a big pushback against more than, if you like, there's a headline agreement that transport is necessary for growth. But when you get behind it, there's a lot of pushback. Partly it's the inbuilt scepticism of people when you want to go and spend some money. But it's partly actually out there. There's still a big groundswell of people who think that there's only a certain amount of growth in the economy, and if it goes here, it won't go there.
Mm.
And if you've spent money to make it go here rather than go there, then what's the point?
Yeah.
Because the growth will happen anyway, I don't believe that. It's impossible to prove one way or another, because in the past the growth did happen, and there were all sorts of other things going on. So getting that isolated out, or getting the importance of place isolated out in an analysis is, you know, economists continue to argue empirical data doesn't, you know, just isn't kind of convincing in any of these directions. I think we've still got a real challenge to get what we know to be almost the common sense thing, no transport, no economy, into, but we must spend some money on Transnorth, on Crossrail 2, on some new roads, because without that we just won't keep up.
I mean, is that fundamentally then about the kinds of metrics and calculations that are used to determine where transport spend will
be? Absolutely.
Yes.
The metrics that are used are entirely in funny money.
Yes.
They're entirely about non-economy creating activity. They're about welfare benefits.
Mm-hmm.
They're based fundamentally still on the assumption that the economy is independent of the transport system.
Hmm. And it's based, and a lot of the, just building on what Bridget said, the analysis of cost-benefit analysis in the traditional model, you know, but value sort of time saved, you know, as one of the key determinants of whether or not it's a good thing. Well, the world's moved on. People are working all the time. And therefore, the way in which we measure the benefit of all of this investment has to shift to the impact that it has on the real economy in terms of jobs, housing and growth, and away from the more conventional things. I think there are some encouraging signs that those sorts of considerations are now being played into the equation. But I think Bridget's right. I think we've got a long way to go on it, and you just cannot let up on making the case.
I mean, in practical policy terms, how did you all feel about, you know, when we saw Lord Heseltine's report on, you know, North Stone and Turn, and, you know, the introduction of this idea of, you know, a very large single growth fund, essentially, that would be put into the hands of city regions to determine investment priorities themselves. Obviously, as we know, didn't quite translate into the action that it might have in terms of the scale of that funding and then what it's used for. But is that the kind of approach that we should be aiming for, to put the power for determining where money spent in the city region, into the hands of elected officials in those areas to determine, rather than it be an outcome of a calculation in Whitehall?
It's undoubtedly right that we put more resources into the local authorities, be it London or the cities, because you will get better outcomes and you'll get them faster. I think there are some riders to that. I think if you're going to give money away like that, then you need to make sure that the city region has got the capacity to be able to deliver. It's where TfL scores in spades, because it's known as an organisation that can deliver. And I'd like to think that Transport for Greater Manchester is in that same area. But it's no use giving that money away if you haven't got the capacity to deliver. Also, we need to get a lot smarter nationally at being able to deliver. And that's national agencies like Network Rail and Highways England to use the money effectively and quickly. And the third part of that, I think, is that in the planning processes that go along with that, we need to be far faster and more agile in approving it. So there are some large schemes out there that are taking forever to get through the planning process, be that HS2 or any of the other schemes, and some of the local schemes still take phenomenally long times to get through it. It's costing money to do that, and it's certainly costing the economy in not having them fast enough.
Airports would be another good example.
Absolutely.
You think the struggle it took Manchester to get a second runway.
Yeah.
Still, there are only two runway airports in this entire country, one in Manchester and the other at Heathrow, which is extraordinary when you think how important international transport is to our survival as an economy, and how all other international airports have 3, 5, 7 runways.
Yes.
So that whole debate and the rancour in it, and indeed it's not finished yet.
Mm.
There isn't a third runway at Heathrow yet, and I've no idea when any spades will get in the ground, and there are clearly going to be some swampy moments before we get there, as you have with the second runway. Making those local decisions is only going to be part of it, because we still need to bang on, as you're right, Vernon, to convince people in general that these things are actually a good idea, and that the disruption that is necessary in the interim is a price worth paying.
Yeah.
because no doubt these things are disruptive. I mean, getting HS2 into Piccadilly, match the Piccadilly, is going to be complicated, yes, shall we say.
I mean, HS2 is something I also wanted to come on to. I mean, it's clearly controversial in many respects as a transport scheme. How do each of you feel about the impact that, once delivered, something like HS2 is going to have at a national level, but also for specifically for the cities that it connects? It seems there is a debate in part about which places will ultimately get the most benefit from it. Whether that will be London ultimately, as places like Birmingham essentially become a suburb of the capital, and therefore is that the kind of thing that national government should be investing in, when, as we've heard already, city regions across the country have their own transport issues to contend with that perhaps the money should go to instead. What's your view on that, Vernon?
Well, for looking at it, if I may, just purely from a London point of view, I think that the main point we'd make is that HS2 has to be integrated with the rest of the transport network. So if you look at the projections for people arriving at Euston on HS2, from 28,000 in the peak times of the morning today to 60,000, once HS2 is firing on all cylinders, clearly London's transport system needs to be able to absorb that and distribute that. So there needs to be integration. There are also opportunities, of course, through places like Old Oak Common for the sorts of jobs and business growth that we've been talking about before. If HS2 is properly integrated into that area, which is ripe for redevelopment, we reckon 55,000 new jobs, 24,000 new homes, and a huge contribution to national GVA. So just looking at it parochially, we think that integration piece is absolutely vital.
Presumably you would agree on that, John, from a Manchester perspective. If Manchester is going to make the most of this, then it needs to be plugging into existing transport connections across the city region.
Well, it does. I think first thing is that HS2 is vital to us. We've got, on the West Coast Main Line, the busiest 125-mile-an-hour railway in Europe, and it cannot cope with the sort of loading that we're seeing on it. By the mid-2020s, it will be completely overwhelmed. Yeah. So we absolutely have to do something about it. In terms of Manchester, the estimate at the moment is something like 1.3 billion GVA additional productivity to Manchester from HS2, 22,000 jobs coming on the back of it. Actually, I think it's wider than that. It's the regeneration benefits it offers. If you know Manchester, then the area from the university, round through Piccadilly, where the station will be, right the way around through the northern quarter, offers a massive regeneration opportunity, and potentially in that area alone, 30,000 jobs. And that's a real goal. But you're right to say that actually the benefits spread much wider than that. It is to the surrounding area, and why we've got to make sure that the connections to HS2 are made, whether it be by the Metrolink, the tram network, or heavy rail, or other ways of doing it, so that we actually get the benefits for everyone in the area, so they can get to that fast link and then they can move around as they wish. The increase it will also give to the airport, where the other station is, it's the largest airport in the north by a country mile, but actually having greater accessibility from elsewhere in the area will be fantastic. And with that's a really goal, it's worth having.
The trouble with HS2 is it was designed in entirely the wrong way. And it's a good example of how Westminster can get it wrong. So it was predicated on, we must have a high-speed network. Nobody quite knew why we wanted a high-speed network, and particularly in a relatively small economy. So they started off with all these things, I've got to go at 400 kilometres an hour, and that is your kind of driving force. And nobody came along to talk to cities, either London or Manchester or anywhere else, about which bit of their city it needed to go to, or what the purpose of that accessibility was. And that's very clear in the National Audit Office review of HS2, where they said, we don't know whether this is good value for money because we don't know what it's for, because nobody can tell us. So then HS2 started by arguing about speed. Then when they started talking about the extension beyond Birmingham, they started to talk about capacity. Though actually, the further north you get, the more speed, in fact, matters to Birmingham. it's not really so important. So I think the lack of consultation in the first instance about where stations would be of assistance to cities would have helped you think about what the railway was for and where it should go. Instead of which, we have Sheffield not wanting a station at Meadowhall, which doesn't do anything for them. They wanted to go into the centre. You've got a real problem with sending it into Euston, and how any of that is going to work. Or, you know, rebuilding Euston is London Bridge squared, cubed, everything. It's going to be extremely difficult. And even in Max Piccadilly, which at least it was going to go to, was it going to go to the airport? How was that going to work? So those whole, the city part of the story, which is essential for making these things work, just wasn't thought of at the beginning. And we're still now kind of trying to unravel how HS2, or how additional network, which we need, capacity, which we need, how that can be plugged into where it needs to be plugged
in. Do you get a sense, Bridget, that that has now been acknowledged, that there was a missing piece of this puzzle when the scheme was devised, and that that was the, you know, the impact it was going to have on urban areas, and therefore it will be different next time around?
Perhaps you should ask these guys. I'm not sure, really. What do you think? Is it being recognised?
I think it was not the best marketed scheme in the Western world, and that's quite clear. However, I think the arguments around capacity are quite telling. I think the arguments about alternatives, around how upgrades would have taken 14 years every weekend, how the upgrade that's taken in the, to plan in the past hasn't worked, are all telling arguments. I think one of the arguments we haven't talked about today is freight and release capacity for freight, but it's an absolutely crucial one for the North, especially as we develop Liverpool 2 as a superport, and the fact that we need to get freight not on road but on rail. So these are all crucial arguments. I think what we need to work on now is the opportunities, rather than agonise about what happened in the past, because frankly the opportunity at Piccadilly is enormous. What we've got is Northern Hub putting a couple of platforms one side of the station, HS2 coming in and putting four platforms the other side of the station, through Metrolink, which currently runs underneath the station. We need to move that around the side. We need to put buses there. Suddenly, we've got a multimodal hub that can be an absolutely integral part to a new part of the city. That's a fantastic opportunity. So I'd rather work on the opportunities here rather than ethereal discussions about what happened in the past.
Fair enough.
Well,
I agree about the opportunities. There are opportunities. I think we could have got here quicker if we thought about it in a different way.
Conscious of time, keen to just broaden the conversation out to conclude with and get a sense from each of you. So whether when we talk about transport investments across the country and within our cities, whether we get the balance in terms of the modes of transport that we think about right. Certainly in the kind of the, in a lot of the public discourse, there is this emphasis on rail and on very big grand projects, essentially. And clearly there's, you know, fairly easy to understand political reasons behind some of that. But when we're thinking about the economic impact that investments can have, actually a lot of the research shows that road investment is just as important, if not more in some instances. So where would each of you sit on that? Do we get the balance right? And if not, where should we be taking it?
Well, I think it is easy to undervalue the contribution that, for example, a bus service provides. If you think about it in the London context, more people are carried by bus than any other service. And it's a reach and frequency which is core to the agility of the city to adapt to growing populations and new business centres growing up and all the rest of it. You know, you can whack in a bus service or increase the frequency of it much faster than you can build a tube line or a new rail line. So I think I think what the integration of transport has done in London is enabled us to make those relative judgments. But I think it is easy to be sort of seduced by the grand projet. And some of the stuff that I mentioned before, if you make it easier for people to use the public transport you already have, you will start to reap immediate benefits from that alongside the necessary infrastructure investment. And don't underestimate what putting on a more frequent bus service can do in terms of getting people to work and leisure and all the other things that they want to do with their lives.
So I think you just have to look at the patronage figures to get a scale of this, but rail in Greater Manchester is something like 25, 30 million passengers a year, which is absolutely dwarfed by bus at 220 million journeys per year. But that's even more dwarfed by 1.6 billion journeys on the road. So it absolutely is an integrated picture where various investments have to be made on all modes, not just one. Different things cost different amount of money. Heavy rail is undoubtedly a fantastic way of doing mass transit, but it's a very expensive way. Actually, what we've got to do is balance that investment across all modes, and sometimes little things can make a big difference. Walking and cycling requires relatively little investment, but can make massive benefits, not just to transport, but also for health and other benefits beyond.
The thing that none of us have mentioned, of course, is the driverless car. And that's something which is clearly kind of coming our way and which will change these balances yet again. The car, a private vehicle, which enables you to go out of your front door and then get out the other end exactly where you want to get to, is obviously liberated people when these things were first invented. But they do cause congestion, and eventually they've crowded themselves out of the market, if you like. So we've seen in London a decline in private car use, and private car ownership, and I suspect that's coming in many other places as well. With, you know, as car hire gets easier, and you'll be able to dip into a zip car or whatever. However, nonetheless, cars aren't going to go away, and freight is not going to entirely go on railway. It's still got the end journey to do apart from anything else for freight. So we will need to continue to invest in roads, and we may need to reinvent our roads when autonomous vehicles come along and you sort of slot yourself into a road train, and the freight is on a road train, which sort of trundles along in some dedicated lane on the road. I have no idea how we're going to do that. That is going to be a challenge which we'll all have to meet within the next couple of decades.
Yeah. And I mean, how do city regions realistically go about planning for those kind of transformational, you know, technology-driven changes in how people move?
Well, you have to trial them. See what works. I mean, we've had electric charging points in London for a number of years, and various incentives for people to take up, you know, less polluting vehicles and so on. So you just have to keep working away at what works. And at some point, the technology comes alongside the demand. And we're starting to see that with driverless vehicles. I mean, I'd appreciate a self-parking car right now. Particularly in London.
They do exist.
They're here now. And the amount of investment which is going in the automotive industry in this area is phenomenal. So this stuff is going to be with us sooner than maybe some of us think. But the only way in which you can prepare for it is, you keep close to the market, you trial, you test, you look at the various incentives you give people to use things, and things like congestion charges and other things like that, you have to take a look at there. But this stuff is not science fiction. It's just around the corner.
Great stuff. Well, that's all we've got time for. Thank you very much to my guests and to you for listening to City Talks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by the Centre for Cities. We're an independent, non-partisan think tank dedicated to understanding and improving city economies. For more on our research and events programme, including our extensive back catalogue, please visit our website, centreforcities.org.